important to protect networks of nature within urban areas. My engineer is Jenka Sodenberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some, actually, I have a new engineer, and I forgot your name. What is your name? Terrell what? Hi, Terrell. Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Robbie Robertson. Thanks for listening.
Yes, it's now 11 a.m. KBOO Portland. And you're listening to Next Health Watch. Takes a look at the Fibro Manual, a complete fibromyalgia treatment guide. And 11:30 is Madness Radio. What is reality? What does quantum physics tell us about reaching people diagnosed with madness? Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO FM and clicking on Donate.
Hi, I'm John Shuck, host of the Below Community. This Friday, I speak with Larry Brilliant. He's a hippie doctor whose guru told him that smallpox was going to be eradicated and that this 60s radical was going to make it happen.
Because God is going to remove one form of suffering from humanity and lift the burden of this disease, smallpox, and it will be unmullen, eradicated.
Hear his story on The Beloved Community this Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Dr. Ginevra Lipton, developed fibromyalgia as a medical student, spent many years using herself as a guinea pig to try to find successful treatments, and ultimately became one of the few clinical specialists in the world to focus solely on fibromyalgia. Dr. Lipton is a graduate of Tufts University School of Medicine, is board certified in internal medicine, directs the Frieda Center for Fibromyalgia, where she has treated thousands of patients with the condition, and serves as medical advisor to the Fibromyalgia Information Foundation. She's here today to talk about her new book, The Fibro Manual, a complete fibromyalgia treatment guide for you and your doctor. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Ginevra Lipton.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
So at the beginning of the Fibro Manual, you describe what it is like to feel like when you have fibromyalgia, that it's really important for people to understand exactly what it is from a subjective perspective. Can you describe that briefly for our listeners?
Yes, I think it's really challenging because people with fibromyalgia, they look okay. They might even seem like they're healthy, but on the inside, people with fibromyalgia can feel that deep muscle ache that you get after you have like a flu shot, that sort of really tender muscle pain. But imagine feeling that all over your body. Couple that with fatigue and never feeling rested in the morning after you sleep. And also sort of a brain fog or cognitive dysfunction. All of that together, brain fog, unrefreshing sleep, all over muscle pain. That's fibromyalgia.
And you say that often fibromyalgia sufferers don't get help from their doctors and that research is lagging far behind other conditions. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One, it's primarily been an illness that has affected women. And I think because of that, and because people looked healthy, there was sort of a neglect that happened where basically medicine said, you know, that's kind of all in their heads. And there really wasn't the focus put on researching fibromyalgia. So I think that's kind of one aspect. The other component is that really it was only very recently that we've been able to find objective or measurable abnormalities in fibromyalgia. Before that, it was always subjective, people reporting that they were having pain. But when we would do x-rays or lab tests, all of those came back normal. So the combination of people kind of appearing healthy and not showing up as abnormal in testing, along with primarily affecting women, I think medicine kind of neglected, unfortunately, fibromyalgia up until about the last 15 years or so. Things are slowly changing.
And you also mentioned that fibromyalgia is an orphan disease, which makes it harder to treat as well. What is an orphan disease?
It's a disease that really hasn't been adopted by any specialty. You know, in Western medicine, everything is kind of segregated into different specialties. So a neurologist is the one that's going to see somebody that's complaining of nerve pain or numbness or tingling. Fibromyalgia spans so many different specialties. It spans sleep medicine, rheumatology, neurology, and pain medicine. And because of that, none of those specialties really kind of has devoted themselves to it. And unfortunately, because there hasn't been a lot of really successful treatments out there for fibromyalgia, there's not been a great momentum for any particular specialty to say, hey, we're the ones that are going to figure out and treat fibromyalgia. So that's what I mean when I say orphan disease. And so then folks like me who kind of specialize in fibromyalgia, we're sort of a little bit orphan doctors trying to kind of create a specialty where there maybe hasn't been one before.
And then there's also some controversy over whether fibromyalgia is a syndrome or a disease. Can you talk about, you believe it's a disease. Is that important that it's a disease versus a syndrome?
I think that's a huge distinction. And I think the difference between a syndrome and a disease is that a syndrome is a collection of symptoms that we see that come together, but that we don't have a definable etiology or we don't know the cause of those symptoms. With a disease, we have, as scientists said, we know what's causing this constellation of symptoms. So for me, I'm really adamant that we do actually know what's going on in the body in fibromyalgia. So we can call it a disease. And in fact, when things are left in the syndrome category, it just leads to further neglect of that illness. So I, in my book, actually kind of say, you know, I know that still typically referred to as a syndrome, but I call it a disease or an illness because there is an overall pathology that we have realized about fibromyalgia. But unfortunately, many physicians even don't know the science behind fibromyalgia. So I felt like a piece of what I had to do in this book was educate my fellow providers that we do know what's going on in the body in fibromyalgia, and we can use that to direct treatment towards successful treatments.
And another, just to add another thing to the long list of things that make it a difficult diagnosis and a treatment plan is people with fibromyalgia also have a higher incidence of other diseases as well. Can you talk about what some of those diseases are that might confuse the symptom picture and that actually coexist with some fibromyalgia sufferers?
Absolutely. I think the biggest ones are irritable bowel syndrome, migraines, peripheral neuropathy or other forms of nerve pain, mood disorders, depression, anxiety. All of those tend to be more common in people with fibromyalgia and can really muddy the waters. And you're exactly right. I think that's made it even harder to figure out exactly what is going on in fibromyalgia, because when somebody comes to their doctor, they might be, in addition to talking about muscle pain, also talking about their headaches or the burning feeling in their feet or, you know, their intermittent constipation and diarrhea and abdominal pain and bloating. So from a physician who's got maybe 10 minutes to have an exam or, you know, office visit with that patient, it's really hard to narrow it down to what exactly is going on.
Hmm. We're talking today to Dr. Ginevra Lipton, the author of The Fibro Manual, a complete fibromyalgia treatment guide for you and your doctor. So you mentioned in The Fibro Manual that in 2002, there was a groundbreaking study that showed abnormalities in the brain, which I would imagine is part of why you could call this a disease versus a syndrome, that there were abnormalities in the brain and how the brain processes pain and fibromyalgia. And you suggest that the only way to see lasting results in the treatment of fibromyalgia with the fatigue, brain fog, and muscle pain is to address what you call chronic hyperactive stress response. So tell us what that is.
So that is the underlying pathology of fibromyalgia that I think warrants it being called an illness or disease. And this has been assessed in lots of different ways, and the science behind it is actually pretty detailed and complex science. But basically, our brain, the animal part of our brain, has two modes, kind of safety mode or danger mode. And for the most part, most of the time, we should be in kind of the safety mode. And only if, let's say, a dog runs out in front of our car as we're driving down the street and we slam on the brakes and our heart is pounding, only then do we kind of get kicked into emergency mode. However, in fibromyalgia, what we've seen is that that emergency mode is kicked in all the time. So when we look at studies of brain activity, of nervous system activity, of how the body is responding to its environment. In fibromyalgia, consistently, 24 hours a day, it's sending out danger signals from the brain. And that leads to a whole host of problems in the body that ultimately kind of creates the whole picture of fibromyalgia.
So are there multiple causes of this chronic stress response? And on top of that, is there a higher incidence of, say, like a history of trauma for people who have fibromyalgia that might have put them in the stress response in the first place?
Absolutely. There seems to be sort of a genetic predisposition, the same way, you know, diabetes can run in families, fibromyalgia can run in families. So there's sort of a genetic predisposition where the brain might be kind of set up or poised to develop fibromyalgia. And then there usually is some sort of triggering event, a trauma that can be either emotional or physical. And that seems to kind of kick that part of the brain that's doing the regulating between danger and safety permanently into the danger part. And unfortunately, we've not figured out a way to kind of help the brain to ease back and regain that balance in fibromyalgia. In my opinion, if we could figure out how to do that, we would have a cure for fibromyalgia. In the meantime, what we're left to do is try and figure out ways to limit the downstream negative effects of that nervous system that's constantly stuck in that danger or fight or flight or stress response.
So you have a treatment plan. You call it the four R's, and maybe we can briefly touch on each of the four R's. So let's start with rest. Sounds simple,
right.
Maybe really difficult. Tell us about the importance of rest and then how you walk people into a place of true restorative sleep and rest in their lives that it seems to be the cornerstone of a fibromyalgia treatment plan.
So you can imagine that a nervous system or a brain that is constantly sending out danger signals, even while you're sleeping, is going to really interfere with quality of sleep. So what we see in fibromyalgia, and I experienced this personally, is you sleep, you may be getting sleep, but you're not getting into the deep quality sleep. So even if you sleep 8 to 10 hours, you wake up feeling exhausted, your muscles hurt, you feel like you've been clenching your jaw all night. And what we see in studies, sleep studies of people with fibromyalgia, is that we stay in the lighter stages of sleep, never really getting down to the deeper stages. And unfortunately, those deeper stages are the most nutritious, so to speak, time of sleep. It's sort of like when you're getting your broccoli and all the nutrients. The lighter sleep has calories, but not really a lot of nutrients. So a huge component of treating fibromyalgia successfully is figuring out, number one, what other things might be interfering with people's sleep. And number two, how do we get your brain to soften and get into deep sleep? I've found that if you do relaxation activities just before bed, that can set you up for a better probability of getting into deep sleep. And often this is where we do need to utilize medications or supplements that can help kind of slow the brain activity so that instead of being in that hypervigilant state all night long, the brain is allowed to get into that deeper, slower sleep. And that's a huge component. I would say that's what I spent 60% of my time in the clinic with folks working on, is getting people into that deep sleep.
So you mentioned, and you often use sleep medications for people, but they're not all the same. Some of them are going to help you get into deep sleep, and some sleep medications aren't. So could you parse that out a little bit for us, and maybe also mention what sort of protocols you would use for people who successfully do it without pharmaceuticals?
Absolutely. So the big challenge is that medications we often think of as being good for sleep, or that are often prescribed as being good for sleep, things like the benzodiazepines, like lorazepam, alprazolam, those medications actually have a negative effect on sleep. So if you go to your doc and you're complaining of insomnia, you might get, let's say, a prescription for lorazepam. That will actually keep you in lighter stages of sleep in fibromyalgia. So the first thing is kind of to make sure that you're not using any medications that negatively affect sleep. And then what I found to be more successful are the medications that are in the GABA class of medicines. So GABA is the main calming neurotransmitter in the brain. So anything that can boost levels of GABA in the brain will help to calm, ease the brain into that deep sleep. So there are supplements that kind of work on the GABA receptors. So some amino acids like GABA and glycine can help with that. There's some herbal supplements that do that. And then often this is where I will utilize some of the prescription medications we typically associate with fibromyalgia, gabapentin or pregabalin. Those are kind of the base of what I do. Magnesium also is vital for brain calming activity. So almost all of my patients, I put on a magnesium supplement at bedtime. So kind of with the supplements and or the GABA medications, that's where we start. And then if somebody also has issues, let's say with insomnia, like they actually just can't fall asleep, then I might add what we think of as a traditional sleeper medication like trazodone or amitriptyline, all of which have actually been looked at in fibromyalgia and shown to be helpful. But what I found is that you might need to use them in combination. You might need a low dose of gabapentin plus a low dose of trazodone. And with that, that combination seems to be enough to overpower that really strong survival instinct that the brain is sending out all night long.
And you mentioned at the beginning of the rest section that you also work on removing things that interfere with sleep. And you mentioned some sleep medications that interfere with good quality sleep. What are some other things that you would want to, other either medications that interfere with sleep that we might not think of, or other activities that people should think about?
So sleep hygiene, which every sleep doctor or physician will talk to patients about, is basically just having good habits around sleep. You know, not drinking coffee after dinner and, not watching a really scary movie right before bed, things that are basically helping your brain to ease into the habit of sleep. So definitely I work with folks on sleep hygiene. And then you want to make sure that there's no illness that's going on, no other sleep disorder that's interfering with sleep. The biggest one here is sleep apnea. Sleep apnea is where the soft palate is kind of closing off. You might be stopping breathing multiple times a night. That's a huge, huge stimulator of the nervous system. It's pretty common in men with fibromyalgia. About 50% of men with fibromyalgia also have sleep apnea. It's more like 20% with women. So making sure there's no other sleep disorder, making sure there's no medication or habit that's interfering with sleep, and then working with medications and supplements to improve quality of sleep. That's kind of the rest component of my treatment.
We're talking today to Dr. Ginevra Lipton about her book, The Fibro Manual, A Complete Fibromyalgia Treatment Guide for You and Your Doctor. Well, let's move on to the second R, repair. Why is there a section called repair for fibromyalgia? What needs to be repaired?
What needs to be repaired are those systems that are being affected negatively by a chronic fight or flight or danger response. And in particular, it affects our digestion. It affects our kind of levels of inflammation in the body, and it really affects how our muscles and tissue are on a day-to-day basis. Because if you think about, remember that example I gave, you're driving down the road, you see a dog run in front of your car, you slam on your brakes. Part of what you do in that moment is you tense your muscles. So in fibromyalgia, that muscle tension is continuous, and it's not a conscious thing. You're not thinking about it. It's a reflex. So your body is continually tensing its muscles, and a huge piece of what we need to repair is actually to restore muscle relaxation. And in particular, I like a therapy called myofascial release, which is like deep, slow stretching that either a therapist can do to your muscles or you can actually do it yourself. And that seems to really, the fibromyalgia muscles seem to really respond to that.
And that's different than just deep tissue massage. And I also remember, if I'm remembering this correctly from the book, that it also is confusing because there are people who use the term that aren't actually doing it. Is that right?
Right. And what I found is that deep tissue massage often doesn't actually help in fibromyalgia. It seems to almost irritate the muscles more. I know for myself, if I get a massage, it actually kind of flares me up for a few days. And a lot of my patients report similar findings. What we see with myofascial release is it's really more like deep, prolonged, assisted stretching where a therapist will have their hands on you, and it might take 3 or 4 minutes before they kind of get to that muscle stretch. So it's a little bit more like kind of pulling taffy. It's not kind of kneading. It's not that kind of movement. So it's slower than people think, but it's by far the most effective therapy I have found for pain relief for fibromyalgia. And in particular, there's a kind of within myofascial release, there's a specific type called John Barnes approach to myofascial release. And that is the one that I think I credit it with helping me get through medical school, because I couldn't find anything that helped with pain. I really thought I was going to have to leave school and do something else or, you know, go on disability. It wasn't until I discovered the importance of fascia and the connective tissue around the muscle that I was able to really gain any sustained pain relief.
Yeah. And you mentioned repairing the digestive tract, and I'd love to briefly touch on that too, because I remember in your introduction about your own personal story, when you did a blood test for food allergies, I believe that was a big turning point for you in terms of improved well-being. Is that what you mean by repair for digestion, or do you mean something else?
That's a component of it. And I have to say, I have a naturopath to thank for that. So I'm eternally grateful to the naturopaths of the world. So what happens with that kind of fight or flight, constant danger signal, it really impairs the digestive capacity. So we see people with fibromyalgia don't make as much digestive acid, so they're not able to really break down the food into its tiniest little components. And what that leads to, unfortunately, is a high probability of food sensitivities and leaky gut. And I'm sure you've talked about leaky gut before on your show, but basically it just means that there's kind of, it's a more porous gut than it should be. So more food particles and other foreign things are getting in to the bloodstream and activating an immune response. So for me, when I got that blood test and I found it was a few simple things that I was eating all the time, like dairy, once I pulled those out of my diet, my inflammation levels really, really dropped. And so did my pain. Then I was able to really work on trying to restore and repair my body's ability to really tolerate and break down dairy. So now I can tolerate it, but only because I've done work to repair my digestive capacity. So that's another huge component I work on with patients.
And what is the blood test or blood tests that you advocate?
So I don't advocate one in particular. I think there's lots of different ways to look at allergies or food sensitivities. Certainly, I like the blood tests that look at the as broad a picture as they can. So the one I like looks at white blood cell activity. It's called the ELISA ACT leukocyte reactivity assay. But I think some of the IgG and other blood tests can be helpful as well. The key to keep in mind is that all of those food sensitivity blood tests only really look at a portion or one section of the immune system response to food. So you have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt and kind of know it might not show you every food sensitivity, but each of them give a pretty good overview, I would say.
And how do you deal with exercise with your patients? There's a lot of research on exercise being beneficial for fibromyalgia sufferers, but it's a hard thing to get people with fibromyalgia to do. So what is your thought process on advice when it comes to therapeutic exercise?
Well, first of all, I tell them to throw the word exercise out of the vocabulary and replace it with therapeutic movement, because the muscles need to move. But exercise, particularly as we think of it in our culture, is sort of, you know, 30 minutes of spinning or, you know, really running or aggressive exercise. That does not feel doable to most people with fibromyalgia, nor to me. I mean, in medical I was like, you have to be kidding me. I feel awful. I mean, it's like telling somebody who has the flu, you know, you should get up off the couch and go for a run. That'll help you feel better. So I tell people I have to kind of reset their expectations and say, you know, we just need to get the muscles moving. We need to get your blood flowing. But first, we need to get you sleeping. So that's why the rest component comes first. And then in the repair section, after you've worked on kind of restoring digestion, working on improving your muscle health with myofascial release, then you can start doing gentle therapeutic movement, starting with a really good warm-up, and then maybe doing 2 or 3 minutes of a gentle exercise to the point that you might not even break a sweat. And then you do some stretching, and then you call it done for the day. And you look at it as medicine, not as a cardiovascular workout. And then you slowly build up. That's how I found it to be doable and effective for people. The warm-up piece is really important. Our muscles with fibromyalgia are tight and tense. And if you just go right into exercise, we're more prone to injury and hurting ourselves and setting off a flare. If you do a really gentle, slow warm-up where you're moving each of your muscles kind of through their range of motion, almost like a slow kind of yoga build-up to exercise, then you can actually tolerate exercise more. And for me, that was like the magic key. Once I figured out that I needed to warm up before exercise, all of a sudden I could tolerate it and I was getting benefit from it. And it was like my aha moment, like, oh, but wait, why is nobody expressing that to patients? So I have a whole chapter in my book that's just about how to warm up for exercise. And I did a whole video that's on my clinic site because it's so important.
And one last question. Unfortunately, I wish we had another half hour so we could go more in depth, but can we just touch on pain medications? You mentioned myofascial release as a specific type of therapy that's particularly beneficial, but if someone's going towards either supplement or medication, what are the ones to avoid and the ones to consider?
Wow, that could be a whole another 30-minute talk. The way I kind of explain it to people is right now, we don't actually have great options for fibromyalgia pain management. We've got some pretty decent ones that can work for a while. So the opiate pain medicines, I think they're useful if they're used just as needed for flares, not every day. Then they can still be a very viable, useful tool. I think anti-inflammatories can be useful on an as-needed basis, but if you're taking them every day, they can actually worsen leaky gut and digestive issues. I really like topical pain medications. There's topical anti-inflammatories, and even some of the newer kind of cannabis-based topicals can be really helpful. Just applied onto the muscle directly. Then you limit a lot of the systemic side effects. I think in the future, in 10 years from now, if you ask me that question, I might have a prescription cannabis that I could recommend. But right now it's pretty, not very scientific. But I think cannabis as a whole holds a lot of potential for fibromyalgia treatment down the road.
And do you have a website you could point our listeners to?
Yeah, the FridaCenter.com is the website of my clinic. And then FibroManual.com is my book website.
FibroManual?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, Dr. Lipton.
David, thank you.
We're talking today to Dr. Ginevra Lipton, the author of The Fibro Manual, a complete fibromyalgia treatment guide for you and your doctor. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon ABLE Savings Plan launch on December 6th at 5 p.m. at the White Stag Building in Portland. The Oregon ABLE Savings Plan will allow people with disabilities and their families save for the future without losing their state and federal benefits. The disability community has worked for 10 years to pass ABLE legislation and are holding this event to celebrate and educate others about the opportunity. There will be refreshments, activities for kids, information, and more. Again, that's Oregon ABLE Savings Plan launch on December 6th at 5 p.m. at the White Stag Building. That's at 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. I'm your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Dr. Arnold Mindell. He is a Jungian therapist with 40 years experience working with individuals, couples, families, organizations, and large groups, and he has also done conflict resolution work in war zones. Dr. Mindell is the founder of Process-Oriented Psychology and has extensive experience working with people diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar, psychosis, and extreme states of consciousness. He is the author of more than a dozen books translated into many languages, and his new book is called Process Mind, A User's Guide to Connecting with the Mind of God. So welcome to Madness Radio, Dr. Arnold Mindell.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. It's a pleasure to be with you and to connect with you and all your guests.
I'm very interested in having you on